Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the fourth episode of the new season of Sukoon. Sukoon is going through a reimagining into a new series brought to you by Nisimco, where we explore the rich history, challenges, and successes of the North American Shia Muslim community. In each episode, we'll sit down with leaders and pioneers who have helped shape our community, contributing to its growth and development over the years. Today, we are honored to have with us someone who has been a pivotal figure in North America, serving as a former Jamaat president of Sijni Jamaat, a long-standing supporter of Nisimco, and a former appointed counselor of the World Federation. As well as in his current role as CEO, Chief Executive Officer of Al Ain Social Care Foundation, a person known for his dedication to community building and his deep involvement in the growth of Islamic charities, centers, and organizations. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Brother Ali Hassan Ali. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Ali, how are you?
Wa alaikum salam, how are you?
Good, thank you. Could you introduce yourself a little and tell us a bit about where you were born, where you were raised, and maybe where you went to school and what you studied?
Sure. So I was born and raised in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. I was there till the age of 18 when I left and came to North America, primarily in New York, for further education. I studied computer engineering for 4 years, after which after I graduated, I got my first job at Citigroup, now Citi, and I was there for about 18 years, to a point where people used to kept joking that, you know, they would name a bench after me or something of how long I was there. After working at Citigroup, you know, I had a small stint at Mount Sinai Hospital, and then I moved on to Morgan Stanley as the global head of software asset management. Then I'm at Al Ain, so I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But
What was it like when you moved from Dar es Salaam to New York? How was your faith? Was it strengthened, or was it kind of okay, where did I come? Or what was, could you describe the community of Sijni at that time?
Yeah, and you know, obviously this was the time before social media, right? So challenges were different. The world was different. Not only without social media, but without smartphones, right? We cannot even imagine life without that. Definitely, you know, a cultural shock like any other immigrant who comes in. But alhamdulillah, you know, I had a good foundation, a good structure, family structure that helped me stay grounded. And through my uncle, Makbul, who always keeps inspiring me, and I always consider him my second dad, he essentially inspired me to, you know, pretty much follow in his footsteps for community service. And that's where the passion started. Through his first recommendation in kind of me serving as a nominated committee member when I was in my postgraduate portion of my life. And that was the start of the passion to serve.
Yeah, that's a great start to your story. So you started your career in IT, and then you moved to the upper echelons of Morgan Stanley, first as a vice president of data strategy, IT sourcing, and software asset management, and then as a global head of software asset management. When and how did you decide to make the move, and why did you choose this path?
So the move to Morgan Stanley was essentially just a typical progression in my career, right? So I had that 18 years where I spent at Citigroup, and you know, I may be dating myself, but at that point, during the Y2K time frame, right, the year 2000 and the commotion that was happening in the IT world, and then eventually the collapse of the Enron organization and the compliance need that came out of it. So I kind of, you know, I had started my career in the software engineering world, but I kind of gravitated towards where my passion lied was, you know, audit and compliance on the IT side. And that, you know, it was an introduction of the Sarbanes-Oxley, requirements and risk control and the self-assessment and all that stuff. So I gravitated towards that, and then that eventually identified its own need of moving on into the software audit world, and how much that space was so new, and there was a need for software license management. And that was around the time when software was being transitioned from physical CDs and drives to software as a service, where you can kind of apply it remotely and install software remotely through the cloud. So that allowed kind of a whole new opportunity from a vendor perspective as well, because they identified an opportunity that, hey, you know what? Companies don't have a good handle on how they manage software licenses, and it's a huge audit gap. So that created its in its own industry of software asset management. And then I just kind of gravitated towards that career and kind of ended up building towards it, to a point where I had, alhamdulillah, received gotten to where my dream job would have been, is at a top four Wall Street company, such as Morgan Stanley, and being the head of software audit at that firm.
I think it's neat that you were there when that transition happened from everything kind of being on CDs and drives, and then it went online. It must have been interesting to see that, because what you see now is the change into AI and a lot of that kind of aspect. It must be interesting to see the similarities between those two.
Yeah, it's always this hindsight kind of thing, right? It's that where you look back and you say, wow, this is where we were, this is where we came from, right? And you never appreciate when you're in the middle of that transition. But once you look back, such as everything in life, right? You look back and, oh my God, how was I functioning without a smartphone or social media? And then now you look back and, wow, we've come a long way, and life changes, life evolves, technology evolves, and we just have to adapt and move on.
So you mentioned you were on the path towards your dream career.
Yeah.
So how did the opportunity of Al Ain present itself, and what made you choose that path instead? And did you have any hesitation?
A lot of hesitation, but for the good reason. So my social service journey in a major capacity started when I became president of our New York mosque, Sijni, also known as Almaty Islamic Center, in 2018. That was when I was still working at Mount Sinai Hospital. I was there for about a year and a half. So during that time, it was we went through a major lawsuit in the community, which alhamdulillah we resolved. We were able to revamp our entire constitution that hadn't been done for like 40 years. So alhamdulillah, I had a great team to support me, and we had some major accomplishments. However, when my second term was about to end, and I knew that I wasn't going to continue on my third term, when I had about 6 months left, I literally realized that, this job is not, when I said this job, I'm talking about the presidency and, everything that I was doing around giving back with the Jamaat. It literally had become a part of my life, because it's a lot of work, right? And there was a time when I realized that this has become how I worship God. Like, I am not someone who is going to spend hours and hours on a musalla, right, or a dua book, but serving God in this capacity had become my form of worship. And it was something that it was a skill that I identified that I was good at, and I was, when I say good, it's relative. I'm sure people will look back and kind of still complain of what I did, but I felt like, it was something that brought passion to me, that made me look forward to it, and no matter how many challenges came my way, it was still something that I look forward to. And when that part of my responsibility was about to come to an end, and I had 6 months left, I started feeling this void. And I'm like, oh my God, what am I gonna do once this is over? Because that's when I realized that this is literally my spiritual cup is being filled with this job. And at that time, they were looking for a CEO for Al Ain. Now, I have a full-time job. How am I supposed to just, volunteer to be a CEO? You can't do that. So it first came along my way. I said, no, I have 6 months left. I kind of want to entertain this. Then when I had 3 months to go and that void and that vulnerability started creeping up again of what am I going to do once this is over? I said, let me reach out. Is this available or is a part-time or whatever, as a volunteer? And turns out it still was, and they were still looking for the right folks. And the reason why they kept coming to me is because, they had heard what I had done with the lawsuit and the Constitution, and they saw that I had a proven pedigree that came with the skills that they could really find useful. So I took the initiative, and I interviewed for that job. And it seemed to be a good match on both sides. And at that point, I started doing part-time as CEO. Now, this was COVID time, so when you're working from home, it's very easy to manage multiple jobs. It's not difficult. But then 6 months later, we started having to go back into the office. And when I went back into the office, now I'm finding myself, I have to run a staff meeting on Zoom. But now I'm finding myself sneaking into a conference room and running and running, doing this, and it was becoming very difficult. And I had to come to a point where, I had to make a difficult decision: where do I want to be? Right? Like at this point, this job was already proving to me that it was something that I really wanted to do because I had the skills for it. But at the same time, I have the other job that feed six individuals in my household. So, I actually particularly remember it was the start of a new year when the same rat race in the corporate world, where you start with the goal setting and employee reviews, and the same rat race started. And I started thinking about that point. I'm like, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing to give back to the world? Right? Like, I literally am making some rich guy richer somewhere, right? And no one cares what I'm doing as far as I'm not making the world any better. Here I have on the other side an opportunity where I can literally make some major change in the world and kind of do some real good. So that was that one transition point and reflection point where I sat down with the family and, we did this analysis, and alhamdulillah, obviously I had their support, because without their support, this wouldn't go anywhere. And before you know it, I did the Sakara, it came out good, and alhamdulillah, I have never looked back, not a single day with regret, even though that was a job that I had dreamed to have one day. Yet giving it up in a heartbeat for this, reminds me every single day that, I am nowhere close to Imam Ali, but at least I get to walk on his footsteps every single day in helping orphan children, right? We're always reminded the story of Habib ibn Muzahir, how he used to be the Imam Hussein's, closest friend, yet every time he used to walk in his footsteps, he was never walked together with him. Because he wouldn't consider himself worthy of his equalness. And we're not even worthy of Habib ibn Muzahir, right? Like, to be compared to him. And but every single day, just to have the ability to have the opportunity to do what Imam Ali loved to do, right? It's something that truly brings a smile every single day, and I'm thankful every single day for this opportunity.
Mashallah, that's a very inspiring story. And I think a lot of us feel that way, especially when we're in our careers at this kind of strange midway point where we've been doing it for a while. And you're right, the employer reviews and all that nonsense. So you start with, and you're like, what am I doing? What am I doing with my life? And I think the other part, I think you had briefly mentioned this before to me, was sometimes you have to give up a bit of your Shia belief, not belief system, but our
Oh
way of
yeah.
life, I guess, sometimes, whether it's the holiday parties that you're kind of
It
expected to
was
show
a
up. I'm sure as
constant
you moved
struggle.
up, could you talk a little bit about that
Yeah.
and the struggle of that, that I'm sure a lot of us could relate
It
to?
was really bothering me. It was a constant struggle. And look, being in the company that I was, it was top four at Wall Street, right? Like you have your Merrill Lynch, you have Morgan Stanley, and all the others. And the higher you go, the more you realize how entrenched the culture there is with bars and partying and alcohol. And it's one thing as far as socialization is concerned after work, right? For example, every year at the beginning of the year, when bonus time comes, right? There's an entire day where nobody works. That day is for announcement of promotions and celebration, right? And in our department of about 300 people, there is going to be our senior manager, like super senior manager, is going to come to our floor, and all 400 people are going to be notified who got promoted. And you are going to be expected to raise a champagne toast. Yeah, like champagne is flowing everywhere, and you are literally standing there. And I'm obviously, I never did that. And I would go out of my way, I remember, to get like a orange soda or something like that to show that it's not champagne, right? Because people are looking at you, why aren't you toasting to your colleague or your subordinate who got promoted? You're supposed to be happy for them. And then after that is done, for lunch, we would, and God forbid if you had a person in your team who got promoted, you need to go and celebrate. We're going as a team to go and celebrate, right? And guess what? When you go there, I remember particularly, there were pitchers of alcohol, right, on the table. Obviously, I wasn't drinking, but in their culture, cheers, right? And he would literally, my own manager would turn over to me and point a cup of beer, cheers. And even though I was drinking water, I didn't do it. But I noticed that awkward look in his face, right? And it is the constant struggle of you're going to be tested, right? You're going to be tested on how strong are you on your fiqh rulings. Who are you going to put ahead of? Are you going to put your cultural and your corporate mentality ahead of it? Or are you going to put the Akida in front of it? And I, till today, I remember I give my son the credit. And at that time, they were like 14 years old. And I kept telling, discussing these challenges because it's important we talk about this with our kids. And I remember bringing this up at the dinner table about, if I, how should I do it? Because I'm struggling. If I don't do it, I'm not going to get promoted. And I'm already seeing those looks. My son looks at me and he says, Dad, so let me ask you a question. You are afraid of the increase in your risk, but you're not afraid to disappoint the one who gives you the risk. And I'm like, whoa, okay.
Wow,
That kind of
mashallah.
gave me that perspective that I was missing, right? And it's always this, I'm always reminded in the Isha Dua, for example, we always talk about God, don't make me run around for the risk. Give me whatever you have ordained for me easily. And I think that was one of the biggest pivotal point where I said, you know what, this is not something that I cannot, I know I am going to not do justice because I will always be in a position where I'll be struggling and I'll be challenged, right? And God has given me literally an out. Not everybody gets a chance to do that. And he literally given me a jumping point where, my family will not suffer as far as financially and I should be okay, inshallah. And yes, it's not the same. It's not Wall Street money,
You're right.
but it at least I can say that, you know what? It's a sacrifice that I made, but at least how many times do we get to say that it's 100% halal income, right? And for those reasons, I'm truly thankful for the opportunity. It's truly a blessing.
You have a very you had a very astute 14-year-old to ask you such a
Alhamdulillah.
question.
Alhamdulillah. I give my wife the credit. I don't take any of that. So a lot of people tell me, oh my God, your kids are so good. I said, you know what? You've heard that at a, apple doesn't fall from the tree. In my thing, that tree is at an angle. That apple fell really far away.
Mashallah, your wife is an amazing person.
Alhamdulillah.
So can you talk a little bit about when did Al Ain start and what position was it in kind of when you took over and where is it currently?
So Al Ain is an organization that was started by His Eminence Sayyid Sistani himself. May Allah prolong his life. And he started it in 2006. So the initial as the program for Al Ain was at the height of when ISIS was running rampant in Iraq, and they were about to threaten the holy shrines in Iraq. So he had put out a call for the community to stand up and go defend the holy shrines. That was the initial call, and it's a famous fatwa that he had put out that everyone must stand, and so many people stood up for this. And the reason why the name Al Ain was started, Al Ain obviously is the eye, right? And it has multiple meanings to it. The initial meaning of Al Ain is the watching eye, right? The reason why I say watching eye is because during Saddam's time, when all the atrocities were committed, and after he was finally, put down, and the local government took over, families went to the taking over government and they said, "Listen, you guys owe us restitution for what Saddam did to us and our family." And their answer is, "We don't owe you anything because there's no evidence." So this time around, when Sayyid Sistani put out that call, the first project was, we are going to document everything, every single thing. Anybody who gave up their life is fully documented. Till today, when you go visit the headquarters of Al Ain in Qazmin, there is an entire floor dedicated towards video footage of those who gave up their lives. Right? So that was the first chapter of Al Ain. Second chapter of Al Ain was obviously the children that got left behind as far as orphan children. Right? And so that is where the second name of Al Ain started, which is the watching eye that takes care of these children. Right? And the goal of the mission became, look, we're not an orphanage. We are an organization that believes that the child thrives best in their own guardianship environment. Right? So we want to provide everything that that child and that mother, or the surviving guardian need for that child to thrive. And so through our sponsorship programs, we provide, for example, it's $70 a month, or right now it's $75 a month. That comes out to roughly about $2.50 a day, right? I can buy a medium Dunkin' Donuts cup of coffee for that price. Yet you literally can save a child, because that amount is not arbitrarily picked. That amount is picked because that is essentially what we need to lift that child above the poverty line, right? So every child sponsored through Al Ain is essentially being lifted above the poverty line. So that was how the program shifted. And Alhamdulillah, till today, we are 19 years into the initiation of Al Ain. We have Alhamdulillah helped more than 250,000 orphan children. They have gone throughout the program. Many of them, Alhamdulillah, have graduated, and they have, become doctors, engineers, psychologists, so many different beautiful professions. And they have come back and are sponsoring their own children now because they want to give back, right? And it's a beautiful thing to look at. And our biggest focus in the entire program is, we want to protect the dignity of that child. Right, we want you to help as a donor, but as much as we can, we do not want that child to feel like they are being helped. Right, to the extent we internally within my organization, it is frowned upon to use the word orphan. I know in Arabic is yatim, yatim is yatim, right? Orphan, but in English, when you use the word orphan, you are labeling that child. Then you are an orphan, you will always stay an orphan. But if you're an orphan child, right, we're emphasizing the fact that you are a child. The orphan part is a victim of circumstances that you have. But we want to make sure, we want to remember you. You are a child. And yes, we cannot change the history that you went through, But we do not want the future to limit you, right? We want to make sure that you have everything in this world, like how my own child does. That child has everything in this world to succeed and to thrive in this world. So that's essentially, the goal and the mission of how Aline started and what we do today.
Yeah. Are there any particular projects within Al Ain that you are very passionate about? I know I've seen pictures from some of the projects, like playgrounds and different things, but are there any particular ones, or do you have any personal stories to share?
No, absolutely. So I have one story and two particular projects that I'm just in love with of what we do. I'll give you one story first. So when I had become CEO and I had gone to Iraq for the first time, we had visited the housing complex. Like anyone who would visit, a complex like that, I stopped by a grocery store. We picked up candies, chocolate, ice cream. I'm gonna go see kids. Kids, who, what kid doesn't love that? We gave it to them. So the kids came, they were happy and they were enjoying it. After a few minutes, a beautiful girl, I'll never forget her name. Her name is Fatima. She comes to us and through a translator, she tells us, thank you so much. And she was like, I would say about 6, 7 years old, right? I swear to God, it reminds me like Bibi Sakina. Okay, like that age. She comes to us, she says, thank you so much for bringing this. But I wish, you would ask us what we want. Everyone comes here and gives us what they think we want, but nobody asks us what we want.
Wow.
And Farhana, you have no idea how much that hit me like a rock. Because we're like, wait, what do you mean?
Yeah.
What do you want? Don't you like this? No, I
And
love it
she's
so
so
much.
small.
But like,
Yeah.
so what do you want? She looks at us, she smiles, she says, I want a Barbie doll. Right?
Yeah.
And I swear to God, that crushed me so much because it made me realize in the privileged world that we live in, we feel like we know what they want. Oh, you're gonna be happy with ice cream and candy and chocolate, because that's what you want. Yet we don't forget that we forget that they're like our children. My child would want, Barbies and cars and this and that. And believe me, that night I told my guys, we're not going home. We're going to a toy store right now.
Yeah.
And we filled the entire car with Barbie dolls. We filled it with like remote control cars.
Yeah.
And we brought back the next day, and alhamdulillah, we brought that smile. But I will never forget that lesson because it taught me something in life that don't ever assume people know what they want. Like, they are to treat them like your own children, and you will realize what they need, So
Yeah.
that's the one story that always touches me. And the second, the projects, we're extremely proud right now of a hotel project that we're building in the heart of Karbala. It's literally minutes from the Haram of Hazrat Abbas, alayhi salam. And it is a unique project because, it is a 15-story hotel where the first five floors stories are dedicated for serving the orphan children. So this is where the orphan children and the widowed mothers come to get the top-notch medical facilities, dental care, eye care, blood bank, all of that, including getting their stipend on the monthly stipend, as well as, we provide psychological rehab services, all of that stuff. But the beauty about this is that it is the first project in its kind where it's a self-sustainability project, meaning not only we are serving the Zawar of Imam Hussein in the top 10 floors, right? But the income generated from those hotel stays is number one going to pay off the entire expense of that building, okay? But above that, it's going to go on and take care of 3,000 additional orphan children in perpetuity, right? So like, the reason why that's so special is because today, if you're a sponsor of a child, $75 a month, you have to pay that every year, or $75 a month for
Yeah.
in its continuity, because that's the support that child needs.
Right.
Here, in this process of being income generating, you contribute towards this project, And in perpetuity, you get the kafala jariyah, which is a spiritual benefit of sponsoring a child, in addition to any sadaqa jariyah benefit that you would get. So it's truly something that we're proud of. And alhamdulillah, the hotel is about 95% complete.
MashaAllah.
And hopefully by the end of the year, we're expecting to kind of do a grand opening on that.
MashaAllah. That's amazing. Any other projects that we should know about?
And there is one major one that's there in Najaf. It's called the Hikayati Center. The Hikayati Center is something that is truly, truly mind-boggling when you enter. It is a center that is constructed to be like something that a child would go crazy in terms of play area and the way it's constructed. It's a science museum, right? And it is done in such a manner where when a child enters, and I'm not saying a child in Iraq, I'm saying even my children from the US, when they entered that place, their jaw dropped because you have all reality is suspended there, and it's like you have entered a fantasy world where you have books floating and you have
Wow.
Noah's Ark and you have the contribution that every Muslim scientist has made, and you can go see what a Muslim would look like wearing a space suit in space and stuff like that, right? And it is created to instill love for learning, right? Iraq in itself has gone through decades, multiple wars, right?
Yeah.
And the country has been devastated.
Yeah.
But the effects that we don't see is that the height of what a child thinks they can achieve in life is a cell phone technician, a barber, a chef. That's all they know because that's all they see around them, right? They don't see that, hey, I'm capable of becoming a doctor, an engineer, a psychologist, a scientist in any way, right? So this center is designed to create, reinvigorate that learn the love for learning in these children. So that the children can see, hey, listen, I'm not just ca not that there's anything wrong with those other careers, but I'm capable of a lot more than just being a barber or a cell phone repair technician. So that truly, every time I go there, it's truly something that has been created. And one may enter and say, this is too much. Like there is a water park, a swimming pool, there is a water slide, that everything that a child in the West would be in awe of, right? We give it to them over there. And for anyone who has told me, oh, this is too much, it's exuberant, I am always reminded of one story, which is when Imam Ali finally got his rightful place as a Khalifa, right? He would have all of these kings of different places send them the best of stuff. And we have a famous story where they would send him the best honey, right? And when the moment he would get that, he would tell them, line up all the orphan children right now, right? Because I've received this. And he would feed them with his own finger the honey, right? To the extent where the companions would say, I wish I was an orphan today because Imam Ali would have fed me this honey, right? And learning lessons from that of how we need to make sure we are providing the very best to these orphan children. Right, so that they never feel like, okay, you know what? I never had a chance in life. But the opposite, I had every chance in life because we had access to all of this. And that's where my love for learning started. And that's where it kind of gets inspired from.
And are there pictures if our listeners want to see what this?
There's a whole YouTube link. Absolutely, I'm happy to share with you.
That would be great, I think. So it sounds like this is an extremely fulfilling job, but are there considerations that maybe we don't realize as being the CEO of a nonprofit? Difficulties in fundraising or logistics with the Iraqi government or anything that you find particularly
Oh,
challenging?
so look, as far as my work is concerned, I head the US chapter of Alain. So essentially, we are the fundraising office in the US side. And by extension, we are the custodian and of the trust that the donor put in us, right? So we will communicate to the donors, this is what the programs we have, and this is the accountability that we are providing you. So my job, and this is why I feel like it was such a perfect fit for me because I come from a world of audit and compliance, right? And the ability to make sure that a donor has a sense of confidence that, you know what, the money I have given is going to make it to its rightful owner, right? And I can literally tell you every quarter when I transfer money to Iraq, okay, or Afghanistan or Ghana, which is the three countries we support. When I send money to Iraq every quarter, let's say I send $500,000, for example, within a few months, I am going to get back a report back. You sent us $500,000, of which it was this much khums, this much sadaqa, this much this, this much that. Here is how we used it. So, for example, if somebody gave sadaqa jariyah and it went to that hotel project, right? I am going to get an itemized breakdown. This is how much we paid for electricity. This is how much we paid for cement. This is how much we paid for this. And it gives you a full accountability that boxes, let's say, off the 500,000, 100,000 was sadaqa jariyah. It will give me a boxed out amount that, okay, this 100,000 made up into this, this, and this, right? And it's a full on accountability. And the pride that comes in getting that information is it reminds you that it is all fueled by a responsibility of who we are representing, right? This is an organization that the Marja started, His Eminence, right? And if you think about it, by association, the responsibility of taking care of orphan children rests on the Holy Imam, right? And in his absence, the Marja takes it on, right? And Al Ain, by extension, is alleviating that burden on the Marja by taking care of this responsibility. So literally, the burden on our shoulders and the accountability on our shoulders is heavy. Because we owe it to our donors to make sure that never ever is there ever a doubt that, you know what, I'm not sure where my money is going. And I want to make sure that whatever I gave, it's going in that bucket. Right? So that level of accountability is something that I'm truly proud of that we provide. And then not only that, but on a quarterly basis, we will provide impact reports of providing them with stats, okay? As of this quarter, these are how many kids we have. This is how many kids that receive surgeries and education and this and that. And what are we doing with the khums money? What are we doing with sadaqa jariyah money? And what the project status updates are. So we'd like to keep that open chain of communication so that our donors feel like, you know what, my money is in good hands and it's in safe hands, and I'm getting that regular accountability, proactive reports without me asking for it.
Where do you see the organization in 5 years from now, or let's say 20 years from now?
So look, my immediate goal, right, and this was evident to me when this job came to me, was I was shocked at that time that I was being asked to be the CEO of Al Ain, and I was sad that my marja has an organization about orphan children, and this is the first time I'm hearing about it, right? And I found that as an injustice to the marja himself. So my immediate goal is to make sure that there is not a single community in the US, right, that is not aware that if you are a Muqallad of Ayatollah Sistani, you should at least, whether you donate or not is a secondary aspect. There's many organizations that do good work. I'm not here to bring anyone down, right? Including NACIMCO, right? For example, right? You guys do amazing work and you're adding so much value. But at the very least, I want to make sure that there isn't a community who isn't aware, hey, you know what? Our Marja, may Allah prolong his life, has this organization, takes care of, 100,000 plus active orphan children today, and it's only growing. Like, we have literally only scratched the surface with all the kids we have helped so far. Just in Iraq in itself, there is 4.5 million children still waiting to be sponsored or who live under the poverty line. So it's a sad stat, but inshallah, one day, you ask me what I would wish in 5 years. It's a tall order, but inshallah, one day I can say that, you know what, there isn't a single community in the US that isn't aware about the organization.
Yeah. Brother Ali, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us. Your dedication to the community and your insightful reflections give us so much hope for the future. You've set an example that many of us can learn from. To our listeners, we hope this conversation has provided you with a deeper understanding of the roots of our community here in North America and the hard work that goes into building and sustaining it. At NACIMCO, we are committed to celebrating leaders like Brother Ali and fostering connections that strengthen our community for generations to come. We invite you to continue this journey with us as we bring you more inspiring stories from across the continent. Thank you for listening, and until next time, Assalamu alaikum.